Every human, every people are united by something, whether you want to believe it's divine or not. Israel is our indigenous homeland. We are from Judea. As a people, we came from there, and we are united by something.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back?
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am. Here I am. With Shai Davidai.
Part of the fight for Jewish civil rights is the fight for Jewish identity. And in the past months, it has been almost impossible to go through the day without being told who we are by people that are not us. We have been called white, we have been called colonizers, we have been called every identity on the planet other than the one identity that we are, which is Jewish. And sometimes when you hear so much hate and vitriol coming at you all the time, it's hard not to buy into it, even if you don't want to. So here's something that happened to me quite a few months ago. I was gloom scrolling through Instagram, and a video came up of a man speaking in Arabic and shouting at Rashida Tlaib. And then he switched to English. And then he switched to Hebrew. And then I realized that this man, who I assumed up until that moment was a Syrian Muslim or a Syrian Christian, was in fact a Syrian Jew.
Yep.
That he may not look like me, he may not have the same geographical background like me. He may have way, way, way better education of different languages. But he is me. He's just like me because he's a Jew just like me. And I'm very happy to have this man with me right now. So here I am with Abi Hamra.
Shai, thank you so much for having me here. Really, it means a lot. And you're saying, you know, somebody didn't look like me, didn't feel like me. And I think the entire Jewish world kind of woke up to that. And we've started seeing each other for who we really are, which is brothers. There's no difference between me and you. We're both Jewish. Our ancestors both went through the same trials and tribulations. And, you know, we're one people. And so there is no difference between me and you other than where I was born and where you were born.
So let's start with that. The question that I start with every episode is, Abi, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm a proud Syrian Jew who is very in touch with my identity and my culture, who appreciates our traditions, and who wants to pass that along and ensure its continuance with our children. So I know a lot of people are waiting for me to say Orthodox, conservative, reform. I don't believe in these labels. I think they're divisive labels. I think for the vast majority of our history, you were a Jew or you were not a Jew. You were religious or not religious. It doesn't change the actual unity of the tribe. We're one nation. We're not Christians or other religions with different denominations. This is not a religion that just a religion with denominations, but Judaism is really a way of being, a way of life. It's something we are. It's an ethnicity, whatever they want to call it in American words, ethnicity, race. It is, we're part of a tribe. We are together from that tribe. It has to do with religion, but that's just one aspect of what it is to be Jewish. So I never took to subdividing myself on religion, which is reform, conservative, or orthodox. Instead, I just said I'm Jewish. I may not be as religious as others, and others may be more religious than me or less.
So why do you think that is, that people are so invested in this like categories, these subcategories of, you know, I am this specific kind of Jew? Why can't we just be all Jews? You know, like that song, why can't we be friends? Why can't we be Jews?
I honestly think it's a uniquely American Western idea. We don't have it in Brooklyn, like in the Syrian community. You don't have a reform synagogue or conservative synagogue. You just have a synagogue. It's Orthodox. It goes by a set of rules. And you either follow the rules or you don't follow the rules. There's people who keep Shabbat and there's people who mechalel Shabbat. There's people who are gay and there are people who are not gay. It does not make a difference as to your observance level. I think in America and Europe, we've assimilated a lot of the Christian way of life. And in Christianity, there are a lot of subsects, different denominations, right? You're either Catholic or you're Protestant or you're Baptist, right? I honestly don't know the difference of all of them. But we've kind of adopted that same idea. And it's been taking more hold now because you're able to feel good with something you did, right? So like, let me put it, give a perfect example. I sometimes, let's assume, use my phone on a Shabbat. I know I'm not allowed to use my phone on Shabbat. That's what the Torah says. What if I believe that it is divine, it is true, I have to agree with that fact. I may not like it, I may not follow it, but that is a fact that exists. I acknowledge that fact, and I continue breaking that law. It doesn't make a difference, but at least I'm acknowledging that fact.
My son does that on dinner, you know. Yeah. He acknowledges the fact that he should be eating, and he breaks the law.
It's like, I want the broccoli, but the chocolate ice cream is really, you know, too tantalizing. But, and I think it's a very important trait to have, because it's a trait of accountability and taking responsibility in something that you believe in. Now, if you don't believe in it, that's fine. That's something completely separate. But if you say, I believe in God, I believe in Hashem, I believe in the Torah, and I believe in Judaism, then these are the rules. You may not like the rules. These are the rules. And the more Western way of doing things, it's, okay, well, listen, maybe they didn't really mean cell phone. Let's allow the cell phone. Uh-huh. You're not being Mechalel Shabbat anymore. You can use the cell phone.
Mechalel Shabbat meaning someone who breaks the rules of Shabbat, yeah, or the edicts.
The 39 Melachot, yeah, and whatever. And to me, that's absurd. It's, yes, you are. You're breaking it. It's in the book. I'm sorry to tell it to you. It may not sound nice, but it's there. And that's the honest truth. When we move away from honesty, we start losing our identity. And that's the crisis that you have today in America.
And yet you even say that you tend to sometimes break the rules.
Break the rules. But I'm holding the authenticity, right? I am saying this is the rule, Shabbat. If I now say, the Torah didn't really mean it, or it's not a real book, then my question to you is then, why do you assume Israel is yours, right? Why? There's a lot of people making arguments that Israel is our indigenous homeland. We are from Judea. We are from, as a people, we came from there, and we are united by something. Every human, every people are united by something, whether you want to believe it's divine or not. In America, there's a constitution that binds you. In different countries, there is something that binds. There's a written instrument with rules and regulations to be part of that society, to be a part of that tribe.
It should be noted that you're a lawyer.
Yeah.
Right? You seem to have a very deep interest in laws and regulations. You are a lawyer. Like
I do, but most of all,
I'm a lawbreaker, so I have less of an obsession.
I'm with you. Break as many laws as anybody else. But most importantly, though, beyond that, is our unity. And I think that's something me and you were really starting to touch on. How do we unite each other? How do we get united with each other? Reform, conservative, orthodox, you know, religious, not religious. How do we unite the Jewish people? There seems to be so many voices coming out from so many different areas that seem contradicting. And we're fighting each other as if we're enemies. And that is opening us up to attacks. The world already hates us. That is a fact that has been a fact for the world's, large part of the world's history. That fact has not changed today. And so the way we need to act with each other is in unity, understanding, accepting, whether you're religious, not religious, it doesn't matter. Whether you believe in A, B, or C, we can have legitimate conversations and we can have diplomatic dialogue with each other. Because at the end of the day, we're stuck with each other, whether we like it or we don't. We're going to unite. I was telling you this. A lot of people before October 7th, and maybe I was included in this, could have looked at the people in Israel protesting and said, what are these people doing? I hate these people. I don't understand them. What are you doing? You're burning a country down? You're burning Israel, our democracy, our Jewish safe haven? Fighting for what? It didn't make sense to me. Somebody had just left Syria. You have your own, we have our Jewish state and we're going to rip it apart fighting each other? I despise those people. After October 7th, and this rabbi, my rabbi as well, you know, we were speaking, we realized something. These people are my brothers. We just have a disagreement. I'm as much as fault as maybe they were. Yeah. I was fighting the person. I was not liking the person, rebelling against the protester, not against the ideas. And those are two separate things that I think we need to come back to. I can still disagree with somebody who stands up and says, I want ABC that I disagree with. That doesn't mean we're divided. But I'm disagreeing with the policy. I'm not going to attack my fellow Jewish person and drag them through the mud and call them names and racists and this. And that is something that I refuse to do, because after October 7th, it became clearer than ever that we're all united. And after every simcha, every party, whether it's a bar mitzvah, during the party or a wedding, people come up to each other and say, about, you know, b'farah, only in happiness, or b'simcha, rak b'smachot, only in happiness. In English, they say it also. And the question I started asking myself is, why are you assuming we're going to re-meet or we're going to even regather? Like, what an assumptive statement that, to make.
You know, sometimes you don't, like, especially if it's family members. Right. Like, you know, maybe this is the last time.
Right.
You know?
But instead we say, may we meet only in happiness. And I was thinking about this for several months, and something occurred to me that the reality is, as Jewish people, we're united, we're together, we're brothers and sisters. We are going to gather, whether we want to gather with each other or whether we don't. So I'll give you a perfect example. Me and family, in a smaller micro sense, you go to a party, a bar mitzvah, and you say, only in happiness. Why? Because the assumption is you are going to gather regardless. Let's not gather for a shiva. Let's not gather for something sad and ugly. Mm. Let's bless each other that we should only gather in happiness. And that can be extrapolated into the macro, right? And we are going to gather. We are going to unite. Me and the people who could have been protesting, me and the people who probably didn't agree with each other before October 7th may have thought we will never unite again. But instead of working on each other to try to find the commonalities that will bind us, we decided to fight each other. And guess what? We were reunited again by October 7th, by a horrible tragedy. And that's the power of unity.
For me, it's very interesting that you bring all this up, because I was on the other side.
Right.
I've been open about it. I was protesting for democracy, and I was, you know, and I've told this story several times already, that I was actually punched by a cop in one of the protests, and it was very much part of who, of what I was doing. I was very invested. Fast forward to around January or February 2024, I was meeting with a group of students at Columbia, and Rabbi D, who's a Leo D, who's a rabbi in Efrat, a settlement in the West Bank, and he came and he talked about what he did on October 5th. And on October 5th, he was leading a gender segregated prayer in the center of Tel Aviv, and he was talking about the anarchist that came to disrupt it. And I kind of leaned, you know, in towards him, and I said, you know, my brother's 30 years old. He works for KPMG. He's like the biggest nerd other than myself in the family. He was there protesting. Those were not anarchists. You know, those were people that disagree with each other. But then, after saying that, I looked at the entire students in the room, and I told them, look at how beautiful this is. Rabbi D and I, we completely disagree on many, many things, and yet we are in this fight together.
Yep.
And what I know is that when we win this fight, and we will, we're going to go back to protesting. But the difference is, we're not going to be protesting out of hate. We're going to be protesting out of love.
Right.
We're protesting because I still believe that my path for the future is the right one, and he still believes that his path is the right one. But we're no longer going to go in the streets blaming the other side, more than just like, here are my ideas. Hopefully my ideas will win.
Right. And that's democracy. I mean, isn't that the joke, right? When you have two Jews, there's 15 opinions. Hmm. We naturally disagree with each other, and it's fine to disagree. It doesn't mean you're evil or I'm evil. It just means we disagree. As long as we both understand and can see through each other that we both have the best interest in at heart, for Israel, for the Jewish people, for ourselves, for our families, that we are not doing it as an anarchist, like you said, like, right? Like, it's the opposite of anarchy. It's something that I believe in, that I want to try to push my point, and I'm going to speak, and I'm going to debate. And the other side can do the same. As long as we're not going out of hate, like you said it perfectly, protesting out of love, That's the beauty of democracy. I mean, that's the beauty of having different people. That's the whole idea of diversity. It's not just to look pretty on a piece of paper or have different pictures or different colors. It's to have different people who have varying different ideas and let the ideas battle themselves out. Let the best idea works. That's how diversity works. That's how democracy works. It's not about the result. It's about that process. And it's done out of love. That's the way to do it.
But then, you know, people would listen and say, why do we need unity? You know, why? We don't need unity. We're fighting for Jewish civil rights. Each one of us can do whatever they want, you know, and why do we need to do this together? Like, give you an example, right? So an Orthodox Jew in Williamsburg, or an ultra-Orthodox Jew, can fight one way, and they'll have their group, and then conservative Jews will have their group, and Reform Jews will have their groups, and I'll form a secular atheist Jews will have our group, and we'll each fight for Jewish civil rights. Why do we need to be in this fight together?
You can, and everybody is. I'm saying, I think we need to, we have to be in this fight together because we are. It's not up to you. It's not about the Reform Jew, and it's not about the conservative Jew or the atheist Jew or the Orthodox Jew to pretend or depend on and to say, okay, I'm going to jump into this fight now, or let's fight this together, or this is not going to affect me. It's going to affect you. This, because the enemy is the same enemy. The ideology that's attacking us is the same ideology that is attacking us. And so, while it's great to do things on our own as well and push our own ideas, not everything has to be like that type of united. When I say unity, I mean we're all doing things out of love and a commonality. They can fight, but they can all fight their different paths, but understanding that what the issue is today, right? And the issue is today, they are trying to delegitimize who we are as Jews.
Who's they? Like, define, like, who for you is the enemy or the ideology?
So we have two fronts on this. I think the overarching enemy or ideology that's attacking us and hurting us has been something that's been around forever, which has been extremist Islamic ideology. It is now by Iran, right? And the Palestinians.
And you're focused on the extremists, right? Because like the vast majority of 1.5 billion Muslims probably have no, like they don't even care. Like they like, okay, whatever.
I'm friends with a lot of them. Yeah. You know the funniest thing? People think I get a lot of threats on Instagram because my videos are not nice and not PC. I just say my truth as is. But the funniest thing is the people I get along with most on Instagram, it starts with them cursing me and they're usually Arabs. Mm-hmm. They're like, you're Zionist. That are, and then we have a conversation. I'll show you after this one conversation. It started with, you son of a Zionist dog or whatever, and hit him right back, and we get to speak. The people who actually threaten me and who actually come after me on Instagram and on emails are the progressive woke white crowd, which is insane to me.
Is that the second ideology that you were going to?
That's the second ideology, and they're playing right to that hand. The extremist Islamist people want to come in here, not to take over America. They have the charter, jihad, make everything Islamic. That is something they truly believe in. It's not just a statement, but that's not what they're doing today. What they're doing today is trying to change the public opinion on Israel and trying to intimidate Jews to stop supporting Israel. Start equating Israel with Nazi ideology, something they've been doing for 5 years now, but we've been sleeping on the wheel against.
But let me, you know, this is really me playing devil's advocate.
Yeah.
But
please.
Every religion has its extremists.
Yeah.
And every extremist, no matter what the religion, believes that my way is the right way and the world should be like me. Maybe the extreme in Judaism, we have the most extremists, but they are not messianic. But both Christian extremists also have this, where, you know, you have the West Baptist Church, you know, cursing out homosexuals and cursing, you know, and going against women's rights and everything. So someone who's an extremist, what you call an extremist Islamist, would say, I was either born here or I immigrated here completely legally. I just tend to believe that the world works with A, B, C, and D. That's the best way. And that's what I'm pushing. I'm not pushing hate. I'm just pushing my view of the world.
Yeah, and you can push your view of the world, but that's not what's happening. they're trying to insist, and there, the extremists we're talking about is that they're insisting on their view of the world take hold. And anybody that disagrees with their view of the world is a lesser, is punished. So in Arab countries, as a Jew, as a Christian, you were a dhimmi. If you weren't going to convert to Islam, you were made a dhimmi and you had to pay something called a jizya, which was a tax.
So explain to people, what is a dhimmi?
A dhimmi is, it came out of Muhammad's first battle. It's a precedent that was drawn from there, in the Battle of Khaybar. And that's why you hear a lot in the streets, Khaybar, Khaybar, ya Yahud. After Muhammad beat the Jews in Khaybar, they surrendered. And as part of their surrender agreement, they agreed to pay a tax, extra tax, which was called a jizya, to live underneath the authority of Islam, of Sharia law, and to basically have different restrictions on their rights. They can't testify in certain places, they couldn't blow the shofar. That precedent was taken by Arab leaders into the future, into the almost the present. It kind of went with the Ottoman Empire, but it was taken into the future. And every leader had a different interpretation on what it meant to be a dhimmi. Are dhimmis entitled to protection or are they not? Because the original understanding from Muhammad is that he gave us this status and it protected us because we were the people of the book. So as long as we paid the jizya, as long as we restricted our rights, we can continue living in this place and not fearing death or assault. Some leaders, obviously.
That's a very low bar, I should say.
Yeah, I know. Right? It's
like,
hard.
It reminds me of, like, there's an Israeli comedian who talks about Am Yisrael Chai, right? The people of Israel live. It's not Am Yisrael thrives. It's not Am Yisrael's happy. It's like, we set the bar as, like, just stay live. Alive. Yeah.
So. It is. And some leaders throughout the generations obviously said, no, you know what? It didn't protect them from all forms of violence. Some type of violence is justified against these Jewish populations. And you saw bursts of violence in Muslim countries throughout history against their Jewish population. Now, there was periods of prosperity and peace and love, but there was periods of bloodshed because that ideology remained with the leaders. It's a very up-down kind of system. So if the mosque says something or your leader says something, as the citizens, you're going along with it most of the time on the extremist side.
So where does the woke progressive ideology come in? That doesn't sound like like what you just described, the dhimmi, and what was the tax?
Jizya.
The jizya tax that Jews had to pay does not sound like something that fits very right. In the whole equality, inclusiveness, identity politics of
100%.
The extreme left ideology.
100%. It's a complete contradiction. However, they have utilized our social systems, our social justice organizations. They have weaponized DEI. They've hijacked that entire movement. I am a believer in diversity, in employment, in diversity in the places of where people live, because I do believe that different ideas bring out the best in us. Whether I agree with you or I don't agree with you, after listening to you speak, I'm going to leave with something I've learned and I'm going to really process that thought.
And I have to say, sometimes what you learn is that guy is dumb. we have to be fair, you're very noble and like, I'm going to learn, like, yes, I try to learn from any interaction. In the past months, like sometimes the learning is the world's fucked because people are uneducated.
Yeah,
I try to be gracious and sometimes like, well, actually they said this interesting point. I need to think about it more.
But, yeah. No, but you're 100% right. It is. It's nonsensical, but they've done it in such a clever way. And they is the pro-Palestinian side. What they did was they embedded themselves as this ultimate minority. They somehow extrapolated themselves from an Arab majority that they live around and said, no, this Palestinian minority, we're a special minority that really are not connected to the major Arab world. But when they need to be connected to the major Arab world, they're part of the major Arab world.
So you're talking about the Palestinian national identity.
Palestinian national identity.
Yes.
They've worked it as a minority, as we're brown, and they've worked on classifying and identifying Jews as one thing and one thing only. White, European, and then they say colonizer, right? They need to do that. Because as long as they successfully define a Jew as white and the Palestinian as brown, on the equity, because remember, the DEI stands for equity. Equity isn't the same thing as equality. On the ladder of equity, they automatically get away with more because they're the oppressed minority and we're this white majority that's attacking them. Now, obviously, this entire narrative was built on BS, but the Jewish organizations and a lot of Jews fell asleep on the wheel. They did not attack this angle enough because they didn't know how to attack this angle. Are we going to be attacking DEI? Are we going to get canceled for attacking something that may seem noble or great by going after this? And they just kind of left it alone, let it simmer. I've been screaming about this for 4 or 5 years now and promising people, like, you're going to be called Nazis very soon and you're going to be punched in the face in the streets. If you look at my videos from 4 years ago, I predicted this to today, to what's happening. It's not that hard to predict. It happened all throughout the Arab world. But anyways, they put them as minorities. The Jews is the ultimate white majority. And therefore, whenever they do something, whenever they do something wrong or something horrible like October 7th, you have to understand, they're a minority that is oppressed, that had nothing, no other power but to resist against this white imperialistic force that is called Israel. Mm-hmm. Now the thing they've been building to sell for 5, 10, 15 years makes sense. Because as an American, as somebody with morality and values, or somebody as a Westerner, you cannot understand, you cannot fathom how somebody is willing to sacrifice their own child as a martyr. You cannot fathom how somebody could stand behind a terrorist organization knowing it is going to cause destruction on their entire life. How do you support that? How are you okay with that? And so as somebody that can't fathom that, because I can't project that on my way of life, I'm trying to project on the extremist Palestinians, or not extremists, I'm going to say something that may be controversial, but on the majority of Palestinians, if I am going to project my beliefs on them, I'm going to be sorely disappointed. And then it makes sense. And so this white, woke, progressive kid is saying, there is no mother on planet Earth that will let her child die unless she knew that the death of that child is going to bring them freedom and going to bring opportunities for the child, because that's what they believe. Yeah. That's the projection part of it. And it's wrong and it's getting us into trouble.
Well, I would say this, that the truth is that none of us really know, and I'm talking about Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. I'm not talking about here. None of us really know what they truly believe, because right. When Hamas controls Gaza, and when some pollster comes and says, like, do you support, he was like, you know there's one answer, right? When the West Bank, which is supposedly, like, more free, but still there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of social sanctions, we just don't know. Is it 90% that agree with Hamas? Is it 50%? Is it 30%? We just don't know.
Why don't you know? That's an honest question. Why do we continue giving the benefit of the doubt? Why don't we know?
So
why
I don't give the benefit of the doubt. I actually, that's a great question. For me, I do not know and I do not care.
Okay.
For me, it's we have a problem, and the problem is Hamas.
Right.
And we need to eliminate Hamas while also trying to minimize civilian casualties.
Agree.
Right? What comes next? That is a second order question. Once we eliminate Hamas, then we can start. I truly believe even if it's 10%, if it's 30%, if it's 50%, there will be someone who's going to come and say, you know what? We'll work with you. Now, our goal, that's my view of it. Our goal would be to work with that person and help that person, that group, that movement, to show them we are working together and help it. If it's a small movement, make it bigger. If it's a big movement, then we win.
100%. But I think from A to B here, there's one step that is crucial and that is necessary, and that is re-education with a partnership from an Arab country that is more moderate and that is concentrating on their success, mm-hmm. like a UAE
right.
that's going to come in. The reason I know, or I say I know, I don't mm-hmm. have 100% evidence of that, is because I don't believe that the people that live in Gaza or that live in the West Bank are above being human beings. And when I say that, I mean when somebody is brainwashing you on a systemic organizational level and brainwashing your entire society for the past 75 years, there is no way you're immune to that brainwash. You're there, if somebody for the last 20 years, from when I was 1 month old, was telling me that if you die and it's the best and that's the goal, and I start believing that. I mean, look, we can talk about it in Judaism and every religion, right? Mm-hmm. Once you start believing, it's almost like a cultish religion of mm-hmm. its own. Once you start believing that, why shouldn't I assume they agree with that? They've been brainwashed. I'm not saying they're evil. I'm not, and this is a major distinction that people are like, is that prejudice? No, it's not. I'm not saying that just because you're born Muslim in Gaza, you're automatically born evil. No, that is a prejudicial, dumb statement to make. But what it does mean is that you are born into a place where you are going to be exposed to nothing but brainwashing through hate for the next 18 years of your life, given a gun and told that your most noble mission in life is to go and kill a Jew. Yeah. How do you, why should we not anticipate them to be along with that? It's not really, you know, it's like Nazi youth.
Hitler, for me, it's very interesting because I think the points you raise are important points, and the fact that we can even talk about them is already progress, because people don't even want to talk about that. The way I resolve it in my mind, and this could be wishful thinking, I'm not saying that I'm correct, but for me, it's like when you go to Yad Vashem, right, the Holocaust Memorial Center in Jerusalem, and you walk through and you can spend hours, if not days, just looking at the systematic annihilation of Jews and thinking, where were people? But then you step outside and the light hits you, and you walk through a small forest where they plant trees, and each tree is a tree for a righteous among the nations, a non-Jew who, despite the education, despite the system, despite everything, acted differently. So for me, it's like, it's where do I focus, right? Do I focus on the fact that, yes, this brainwashing system, the machine, pushes out hate? And that is, again, happens in many societies on different angles. Or do I focus on the trees? Do I focus on the righteous among the nations? And on the truth is, we should keep cognizant of both. Yeah. That, you know, we should learn about what makes the good people good in order to fight the bad.
Right. Actually, I think, beautifully said. Like, really concentrate on what makes the good good, and how did they break out of this brainwashing? But I think the issue that there is a Yad Vashem museum in the first place, that there was a Holocaust in the first place, that 6 million Jews died in the first place, and that the German population was on whole okay with it. Yes, were they righteous among the nation? 100%. There's always people. Human nature, humanity, right? And the Nazis didn't have as much time as the Palestinian Authority and Palestinian leadership, from PLO to Hamas, to brainwash that population. They didn't have it entrenched in their actual books, in actual religious fighting of jihadi religiously. It wasn't that same ideology. What's happening is you have an extremist ideology of Islam. Now, it states that once, and this is the issue with Israel, once this country becomes Muslim, or once you convert to Islam, what that means is that you've surrendered to the will of Allah. And since Allah only loves Islam, and it's only the only true religion in the world, moving away from that religion, unconverting from Islam, is now major infidel level, right? Like, what are you doing? You're now rejecting Allah after you've accepted it. And that was ISIS, right? That's what ISIS was blowing up half of Europe for, part of the reason. Spain is ours. Spain was a Muslim country. It had a mosque. It was a Muslim country. We want it. Why? Because it was at one point of history. And because it was, it can't be converted. It is an ideology that is very seeped into the culture. It is, and I do a lot of work with interfaith and Muslim organizations. The thing I tell them is this: you can go home, you can open your Al-Fatiha prayers. In there, you curse the Jews and you curse the Christians, and you can do that. And I'm okay with it. And I won't tell you to stop doing it. I don't need you not to believe that we are a cursed people. That's fine. Believe that. Don't discriminate against me in the streets. Don't commit violence against me in the streets. That's what I need from you.
But wait, again, pushing back a little bit, because they can say, you can go home, read segments of the Torah, of the Talmud, Haggadah, and it says, Shvoch hamatcha al goyim.
Yeah.
Right? Like, spill your ire on the non-Jews, on the people.
Right, but that's two words out of a contextual talking about attacking, if the goyim is attacking you. Let me tell you, the Torah rules of war are not as nice and pretty with flowery. This turn the other cheek loveliness comes from Christianity. Mm-hmm. It's not Judaism. Judaism is, the Torah says, if somebody stands up to kill you, you must. You have an obligation to get him before he even reaches you. You have an obligation. Life is precious to us. We preserve it at all costs. Hmm.
So, you mentioned two ideologies. What about the third ideology? Where do the neo-Nazis, the extreme right,
It's a lovely circle. Nazis historically have tied up with the Palestinian ideology. From whether it was the Grand Mufti, Husseini, who was kicked out of Jerusalem for revolting against the British, made his way down to Iraq, where he linked up with the Nazis, who he's been talking to, he's been great friends with, he visited the concentration camp, they called him an Aryan. Linked up with them, overthrew the newly established Iraqi government, and put in place Rashid Ali as prime minister, who orchestrated the Farhud that led to 150,000 Jews being displaced, over 800 Jews dying in a single day. Massive tragedy in a place where 20% of its populace were Jews, in Baghdad. The reason they were able to work so well together, the Grand Mufti and Hitler, is they both believed in supremacy ideology. They do. Hitler believed in white supremacy. It is going to be our way or death. The Grand Mufti believed in his supremacy. It is going to be all ours. It is going to be our way. We're going to reestablish this caliphate over this entire region, or it's going to be endless war. It was an ideology that they both were able to understand, and it was a joint hatred for one people, and that is the Jewish people. These moral, these annoying Jews bothered both of them, but bothered Hitler, bothered the Grand Mufti, bothered many others. That's where it's the shoe horse theory. That's where it's coming around together with the crazy left. You have the Candace, you know, the crazy right, the Candace Owens. And then you have somebody like AOC who became best friends overnight. Like, you believe in everything against each other, but one thing unites them, and that is the hatred of us, which makes it that much important for us to unite, to fight that united hatred.
So how do you fit into all of this?
I give a different voice.
I wouldn't even say speaking up. You started shouting out about 4 or 5 years ago. Why? What led you?
My goal was really understanding the mode that they were operating in, the pro-Palestinian side, the DEI mode, and what they had to cement and prove for it to take effect and work as well as it's been working for them today, is that Jews are white. My existence completely tears a hole in that fabric of BS. Jews.
For people that are listening in and not, you know, and don't know who you are, what you look like, I don't think, you know, stopped, you get stopped in a car, you know, on a traffic, I wouldn't call you white.
Right. No.
I myself don't identify as white, but I can understand that I pass as white. I think it would be hard for you to pass as white.
I agree. If you want to laugh, my 8-year-old son was in school and they gave him a project, his Mother's Day card. And so he drew a Mother's Day card. My wife is half Ashkenaz, half Israeli. And so she's much lighter than I am, like much, much lighter. And much lighter than my son. My son's even darker than I am. So he drew a picture for Mother's Day for his mom. His mom was fully white. And the only crayon he had was black. And so he drew himself as black and he wrote mommy and me. And he brought it home and I'm like, what is going on? He's like, Dad, I don't look like mommy. Mommy has lighter skin. I have darker skin. That was the only crayon that fit. We're not white. Jews were not white, but there's no way I can pass as a white person.
Yeah.
So my existence completely tears that up. Now, what I went through as a Jew from an Arab country, as somebody who was born Jewish in Syria, also breaks this entire idea that these people, this region, what happened to them, that they're the oppressed and were the oppressors, that they were the only ones that had to leave their homes. The Nakba, 350,000, then it went to 500,000, now it's, I think, 700,000 Palestinians left their homes during the Nakba. Okay, 850,000, a million Jews left Arab countries and were displaced and became refugees because of, we don't have a name for it, because we just didn't go with the victim card, as the Palestinian society did.
Well, to be fair to people that believe and push the narrative of the Nakba, they would say, you don't have a name for it because you were displaced. Let's say they agree. Sometimes they completely dismiss our history. But let's say they agree that we have been displaced, violently displaced, but we moved to a place of our own. And they would say, we were displaced and we're still displaced. What would you say to that?
It's a very clever, clever argument. I would say, first of all, BS. The idea that there was a Palestine for them to be in, and it was their place, and solely their place, mm-hmm. is bullshit. And we must call it out for what it is. Completely bullshit. It was an Ottoman Empire that fell. And when that happened, not only Israel, but Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, these are all creations. These are all new countries, new states. They didn't exist. It was all ruled under one caliphate. So this idea that you, a supermajority, are now upset and want to take the land, the small sliver of land that this minority that historically lived in these areas and was oppressed by you, majority, now you're coming and saying, oh, it's not fair, we want more of that land. Imagine this, the United States of America fall. Okay, the United States falls and there's 50 states with no country. An international body comes in and says, you know what, we're going to start dividing these states up and giving them to different, we're going to call this Syria, we're going to call this XYZ. They realize that Native Americans in this country were mistreated, deprived of their assets, kicked out, really ethnically cleansed in a lot of forms. So they say to make that right, to right this wrong, this portion of land is now Native American. The rest of America can be white and remain white, run by white people. Let's assume that's how we're breaking it, because that's how it works in the Middle East, religion. That's what it's based on. The rest of America is run by white people. And so what's happening here, and let's assume America is that region and Israel is the small native land. Now, you are also going to add restrictions on this small new native land. It must be a democracy that allows everybody to vote, while everybody surrounding this small little native land can be a complete dictatorship, a theology. You must also allow white people to come into your land and to have the right to return to this small new sliver of land that you've been getting. There is a white population that lives within that land. The white population then argues, we were here. We were the majority of all of America. This is wrong. This is unfair. You're stealing my land. Why is there a native land? Well, we're indigenous to this land. The white person crying, or the KKK individual crying because a black individual won an election for the first time in history in a town that always went white, does not mean that that person is justified. That means that person's a racist. Because I don't care, what does it matter if it's called Israel, Palestine, XYZ? It doesn't matter. As long as it's a democracy that gives rights to the people that live within it, that is equal rights, it shouldn't matter. The only reason it should matter is if you're that majority white trying to protect that majority status and going to this Native American, or in this case, the Israelis, and saying, or the Jews that lived as dhimmis in this region before that were subjected to violence and discrimination, saying, well, you know, you're discriminating against us because you're holding on to that small piece of sliver of land in your indigenous homeland. It's bullshit.
So let me, you know, there's a thing that keeps running in my mind, and I'll be honest with you. I'm wondering whether I should ask you, but I'm like you. I'm like, I'd rather ask than not ask, and then we'll figure it out. And I'll cut it out. I'll edit it out and make myself sound smarter. But when I told people that I will be interviewing you, several people said, like, you know, be careful. He seems a bit aggressive, a bit abrasive. And I know that people, by the way, think that about me, you know, that people don't like my style sometimes. People might worry that, you know, he's too right wing. He's too militant. He's too, but then I don't know how long we've been speaking, but you don't seem militant.
No, I'm not.
But are you, have you been getting this feedback? Are you aware of it? You come out more.
I come out different.
Yeah.
And I think the Jewish world needs to start getting comfortable with hearing a voice that they haven't heard. And that voice is the voice of the Syrian Jew, of the Mizrahi Jew. You come to my house for Shabbat. I'm inviting you. You think we're all fighting. You'll think we're going to kill each other.
You know that everyone's listening now, so you have...
All of you are welcome. 100%. I would love it. Are you kidding me? But we're, that's how we speak. We're passionate people. We speak with force, and we're straight up. We're going to tell you the truth to your face. You're going to like it enough. I was at one of these protests. Somebody told me, somebody did give me the feedback. Calm down. We don't scream. That's not our way. I'm sorry. How much have you studied of what it is to be a Syrian Jew or a Mizrahi Jew? I get told all the time, oh, you guys eat matzo ball soup. That's the staple Jewish dish. Really? My mom doesn't know how to make matzo ball soup. Until I married my half Ashkenaz wife, I don't think I've really eaten matzo ball soup. Or bagels, cream cheese, and lox. That's the Jewish way. No, we were shocked that you're putting fish on cheese. Like, it didn't make sense to us coming from Syria. So it's different. And I think this feeling of being uncomfortable is really because it's the different voice. But this is my challenge to those people. Your voice that hasn't been different for 50 years, 60 years, where has it gotten us? It has gotten us to where we are today. It is. I am sorry. ADL has existed and they're great. I am not bashing them. They're good. They're an organization that has its purpose, and that's fighting anti-Semitism. Why didn't they catch this anti-Zionist anti-Semitism before it completely exploded? Just a few years ago, they stated the biggest threat to Jewish life and to Jewish existence in this country was white supremacy. They did not catch it because they are too much of leftists or whatever other BS people want to throw. They didn't catch it because they didn't have enough diverse Jews in the organization to say, wait, this type of anti-Zionism is reminding me is exactly what happened to us in our home country that led to our ethnic cleansing. There was no mechanism because there was a lack of diversity in the Jewish world that still exists till today.
So part of fighting for Jewish civil rights is also tikkun bayit, like making sure that our home, that we are diverse as Jews and the non-Jews that are fighting.
100%. And here's the funny thing, by the way. I'm not a right winger. I'm not a Republican.
Yeah, I have something I actually want to read. You posted years ago now. I wonder if you still believe in this. You wrote, I have voted for Democrats, Independents, and Republicans on a single ballot.
Yeah, I still do it.
Why? Because that's weird. Don't you think that's
weird? No, I don't. Because
I love it.
America wants democracy, but then hates democracy. You got, like, I tell people, you think you live in a democracy, but what you're living in is 4 years of totalitarian government. Whether you're a Democrat or you're a Republican, if the Democrat wins, everything Democrats want goes into effect. And it's been becoming more and more polarizing.
Republicans.
It is, I'm not going to vote for totalitarian regimes or rules. And that's exactly what I would be doing is if I just vote based on somebody's R or D or I. I don't follow people. I don't idolize human beings. Even if I look at the policies, somebody can be a Democrat and share the policies that I believe in. I am a very big believer in social liberties, social rights. I would always stand up with the gay community for gay rights. I would always stand up for women for their right to bodily, you know, choice. I have no shame in saying that. But I'm also saying you guys are insane if you think, you know, my 3-year-old son comes to me and tells me, hey, daddy, I want to do this. There's a line to it. Like, I'm using logic. I'm having a conversation. And if you are a politician that's a Democrat that agrees with social issues and hates Israel, guess what? I'm not voting for you because I don't care. Israel, Jewish safety as a displaced Jew is on top of my ballot. And the reason people are calling me right wing today is because unfortunately, the more and more people have been standing up for us are people we may have not wanted to stand up for us, which are coming from the Republican side, like Representative Elise Stefanik, who has been phenomenal for us, but she's a Republican. And so they're thinking I'm Republican. No, I'm not. I'm just supporting those politicians because they're supporting my policy ideas. And when I go against a politician that's a Democrat, I'm not going after him because he's a Democrat. Mm. For instance, Nadler.
I tell people, and I want to get to your thing about Nadler because I know that that touches its nerve. But I tell people the Democrats will not save us from anti-Semitism on the left, and Republicans will not save us from anti-Semitism on the right. We have... All Jews must be independents and vote for whoever you want.
100%.
I mean, let's talk about Jerry Nadler. I know that you're itching.
Jerry Nadler is 100%. And just to end off here and it's like to really speak about the why I concentrated on left-wing anti-Semitism more than on white supremacist right-wing anti-Semitism. Because when white supremacist right-wing anti-Semitism comes out, almost everybody calls mm-hmm. it out. Mainstream media. I mean, think about the people who are walking with tiki torches. We're still talking about them today. And what they do, they marched one night saying Jews will not replace us. There are debates whether the people in encampments on college campuses are even anti-Semitic. So that is why I concentrate on that side more than the other side. But Jerry Nadler, I have no issues personally with Jerry Nadler. I don't know him personally, but I am a man of my word. I am somebody who fights for something I believe in, and I'm going to continue fighting for it. For years now, Jewish organizations, a lot of Jewish organizations, myself included, have been fighting for IRA's definition to take hold and to be adopted in institutions. As you know, unless something is defined, it becomes very hard to utilize it in a case or to report it to the EEOC or whatever it is, because you can say it's anti-Semitic. They're going to say, no, it's anti-Zionist.
And to be clear for people who don't know, the IHRA, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, acknowledges Israel as part of the Jewish identity, and you can criticize the government, you can criticize policies, but you cannot call for Israel's existence to come into question.
Right, as long as you're not using double standards in your criticism, right? You're fine. You can criticize. The actual definition states it is legitimate to criticize the policies in the state of Israel. I mean, most Jews do. Some Jews don't. It doesn't. It's not really the debate here. IRA allows for that. But for years, we have been demanding how important it is. Last week, they did something in New Jersey. They were having a hearing. And you got every single organization sending out blasts. Call New Jersey. We want them to adopt IRA. We must have New Jersey adopt IRA. But they were silent when Nadler defamed it in a Politico interview completely, saying he fears that it could chill free speech, that saying anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism could chill free speech. That was Jerry Nadler's major concern after months of what we've seen.
And for people who don't know, Jerry Nadler is a Jewish congressperson. Yeah.
And so New York. I called people up. I said, I don't understand. If we are not going to go out there, if we're not going to stand up and we're not going to voice our displeasure, whether you like Nadler, you don't like him, if he just did this thing, if we are not going to protest this act, the message that it's going to send is that when you act against Jewish interest, there are no repercussions. When you act for Jewish rights, expect a storm of pro-Palestinian protests outside your office. So if Jerry Nadler would have supported IRA, clapped for it, and signed it in, he probably would have gotten a nice amount of people outside of his office calling him a genocide supporter and a murderer. And he's afraid of that because he's in the business of votes. But he understood that if he acts against the Jewish people, if he defames IRA, these people are not going to come against him. And guess who else is not going to show up and protest against him? The Jews. Why are we not there? Well, he's Jewish. Oh, he's good. He's a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. Why are we living in this privileged American mindset? We do not have the privilege to be Democrats and Republicans, and we must, if we truly care about our civil rights, stand up against those hurting our civil rights. If IRA is instituted, where's that bill passed, by the way? That bill passed the House. And today it's sitting on Schumer's desk. It passed with bipartisan support overwhelmingly. Schumer hasn't moved it. He's not going to move it. Why should he move it? It is not politically convenient to do it. We are giving these politicians an out for fighting for us. And it is the stupidest thing we can do when we have the majority Senate. He's the majority of the Senate. He's the majority leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer. We need to be, you have this IRA bill on your desk. It needed to move to the Senate floor for a vote yesterday, not today. Why is it still on your desk? Why is it not moving? There are kids on college campuses, they're, you know more than me, who are eating crap and who are having a hard time reporting it because they're saying, well, that's not technically anti-Semitic, which isn't the case. There's Second Circuit law, by the way, that says anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism because the country... most of its populace is Jewish, therefore we can assume that discrimination against Israel is discrimination against the Jewish people. There is that established case law in Second Circuit in New York that does exist. But the students, for them to really fight anti-Semitism, for administrations to fight it, you need to define it. Today, there is no accurate definition, and Nadler bashed the only definition that we have, that we've all been fighting for, and there has been silence from the Jewish world. I make noise.
Why do you think, you mentioned Nadler and Schumer, probably the most prominent Jewish senator and Congress member. Why do you think they're holding that up?
I don't think they're horrible human beings. I don't. I don't see people like that. I see people as people that are motivated by their own interests. And their interest is politics. Their interest is retaining voting power, retaining popularity in this country. They are seeing...
And it's not popular.
It's not popular to be pro-Jewish, and there is no costs involved with being anti-Jewish. Mm. Think about it. Who came with me to protest Nadler? We had maybe 15 people. Schumer, we had 100. Fine. But Nadler, we had 15. If he would have... done something monumentally great for Israel, do you think there would have only been 10 or 15 pro-Palestinian
people? If he was not Jewish? Would there be more people with
I think we should double up our efforts on the on the fact that he is Jewish. Because what he's sending is an even more dangerous precedent. He's sending that message to the non-Jewish people in Congress with him, in the Senate with him. Hey, don't be stupid. Don't go with the Jews.
So I actually want to show you a video of you very early on. I think it was October 8th or 9th. And because when you speak with me, people realize like how you're a softie. You're a softie.
Yeah, I am.
But this is what people see. So I want you, we're going to start from minute 104, 102. So when you speak, I find that there's something extremely compelling about you. And I think that's what people are reacting to. So I don't know if you've seen this video in a while. I want you to watch 1 minute of this.
There is none. But yet, in New York City and around the world, we are seeing these pro-Palestinian rallies. What are you protesting? The murder of innocent civilians? The raping of women? The killing and the abduction of children? What are you protesting, you animals? But understand this. Although you scream and you cry that Israel is a colonial project, that we are some white oppressive colonialists who wandered onto Israel, and that these actions are going to get us out, although that is what you state, you may have fooled yourself into believing that, because we are not colonialists. We are indigenous to this land. What you can't stand is that the Jew is no longer a dhimmi, subjugated to the oppression of the Arab countries. The Jew is free.
Where is this anger coming from?
From seeing how warped and upside down the world is. As somebody... deep down inside, I am sure that there is a subconscious trauma that is speaking. Somebody who left their home. Look, you know, maybe I was 8. I was 8 years old when I got to this country. I was born in Syria. I saw my dad starting over. When we came here, he had 4 children. We had to literally start from nothing. We couldn't leave the country before 1992. It was illegal for Jews to immigrate out. Until the U.S. reached a treaty. I was attacked in Syria by a Palestinian for being Jewish. They came into Syria. The Palestinians came, the Palestinians that came into Syria, A lot of them took the homes of the Jewish population that lived there in the Jewish quarters for free because 30,000 Jews went bye-bye the night before. The others were placed in refugee camps outside of the Jewish quarters, and they preyed on us. They preyed on the Jewish community until the day we left. Syrian, regular Syrians, Muslim, Christians, we didn't really have much issues. It's when you were dealing with the Palestinians that were living in these communities. They would attack us, they would target us, and they were successful in ethnically cleansing us from our home. My father had to start over from zero. He had to build a business. He had four children at the time. We have five now, but he had five at the end. But he started over. I started, you know, I came here. I didn't know English. I didn't speak the English language. We didn't have money. We were building a life. We were immigrants in a new country. And I worked my ass off. Went to law school, graduated top of my class in law school, top of my class in undergrad. Started a law firm. I've reached some level of success. My brothers, my sisters have reached some level of success. And I guess there's a subconscious fear of if I don't fight back with every fiber in my being, am I doing a disservice to my children? Am I going to have to now go and uproot my life again and have my children exposed to that same trauma, that same BS that I had to go through in a land that wasn't theirs, in a culture that wasn't theirs, in the language they didn't speak? I don't want that. And you know what? Today I'm asking myself that question every day, and I had this conversation with my wife. I said, are we being selfish? Are we being selfish for not moving to Israel today? She's like, well, we don't know the language. I'm like, I know. But my dad didn't know the language. My mom didn't know the language. They saw that this place is not safe for Jews. We need to get out of here. We need to give our children an opportunity. By staying in America because it is convenient for us, because we are going to have to restart at the age of 30-something or 40-something, are we doing a disservice to our children? Should we move to Israel from now so at least our children can learn the language, can be somewhat local, so their children can be real Israelis? And because that's what I went through, right? Like my dad left, and that was a real question. I just refuse to believe that it's over. And so I want to fight back, and I want to fight back the way I know how and when I speak. I don't plan it. This isn't something I'm writing or I'm smiling or I'm trying to get likes or I'm trying. I had no likes, no followers. It naturally came, and I would love my voice getting more amplified, but I'm not going to hold back what's in my heart. I'm speaking honestly, straight from my heart. It's not pre-planned. This is real for me. This is, and for you, and for a lot of other Jews. But this is a life that I've lived that's coming to revisit me. This is a trauma that I left that's come back to me.
Somebody asked me, who does your social media? And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's me at 1 a.m. doing like, you know, I got to work, I got to have my children, and then I'm doing this. It's not pre-planned. It's not organized. It's not, you know, it's a fight. I must say, I don't think there's anything selfish with you staying here. You're fighting. I presume that you're teaching your kids to fight. Yeah. You're taking on an entire community. The Syrian community, the Syrian Jewish community, and the Jewish community in general, and fighting for all of us. There's nothing selfish about that.
I appreciate it. But no, I would hate for people to think that I'm an extremist or I'm crazy or I'm ideological in one way or another. I believe that I'm a logical person, even with my religion. You know, sure, I learned a lot in yeshiva, but I went off to college and I lost everything I learned. And I built my own religious journey, my own finding way back. I hate ideology. I hate cultish behavior. I hate following and falling in line. I'm somebody that's going to do what I feel is right, what I feel is logical, what I feel is moral. Now, the way I speak, that's just how I speak. I will talk with passion because the other side is talking with passion and it's winning. People are scared. Yeah. You have a generation of very weak, spineless individuals. And that's what's happening on college campus. You're seeing this uninvolved white kid from South Dakota come in. And we're all shocked. Like, how could he join the Palestinian side? I don't understand this. Why don't you understand this? This is very easily understandable. Just following human nature. He comes from South Dakota. Let's assume I'm making up a state, yeah. Right? He comes. He's white, uninvolved. He can care less about Israel. He can care less about Palestine. He can care less about the Jews or the Palestinians. And I think that is a true statement, the majority statement about a lot of these white, uninvolved progressives. They come into campus and they see one side. And that's the Jewish side. And the Jewish side has, for the longest time, been very calm, very nice. You can be both. You can be very pro-Palestinian. You can be for Palestinian determination and for their own independent state. And you can be pro-Israel and pro-Jewish rights. We have nothing against that. We love everybody. And then you look on the other side. You utter the word Israel. You're a genocide supporter. You should be canceled. They utilize the same thing that BLM utilized, which is shame. I ask people all this time, whether you agreed with BLM or you disagreed with BLM, I dare you, if you disagreed with them at the time the protests were happening, to go to in front of your business and hang up a sign that says, I hate BLM. You wouldn't. Why? Because you don't want to hurt your business. You don't want to get canceled. Same thing is true for this uninvolved college kid. He's coming here. I want to get drunk. I want to get girls. Maybe I'll learn something in college. But that's my priority, one and two. Be popular, get drunk, and get girls. Me going to the Israel side, maybe it's right and nice and moral and beautiful, but I'm going to get canceled. I'm going to get shamed. I'm going to get destroyed. So let's go to that louder, scarier side. Okay? We need to show that, hey, you know what? You continue this. We're also loud. We can also cancel you. We don't need to be your friend. And we'll say our truth and we'll speak it the way what we believe in. And we're not going to hide our identity from you. And so that's why people think I'm extreme. It's like, well, you're talking about two states and you're talking about three states and one state. Like, I think that conversation, that entire conversation is an illusion. It's a useless conversation to have. For example, would anybody feel comfortable in giving two states today? Would the Palestinians feel comfortable in accepting two states today? No. And this is what Jews always say. We've offered them peace deals how many times? And they've always rejected the peace deals. Well, I think it's a little presumptive for you and arrogant for us Jews to say, we've offered you peace, and you've denied peace. We Jews have never offered them peace. Because offering them peace equals to offering them the entirety of the state of Israel. We don't want to believe that's the case, but that's the case. And so you are very arrogant to say, hey, I offered you half, come on. I offered you peace. No, you didn't. That's not the offer they're looking for. So why are we superimposing ourselves on what they want? I'm not going to give them the majority of Israel. So to me, there is no such thing as a two-state conversation today because there is still an ideological, extremist way of thinking in these areas that is not going to allow them to live in coexistence and in peace with Israel and to accept its sovereignty. Until the UAE and other Arab countries in unison, because I don't think Israel can do it on its own without another Arab country that knows you need to get a little tougher on a population than Israel is willing to do. An Arab country would be willing to do that. And they could de-brainwash that population. I don't know if that's even a real word, but desensitize, de-brainwash that population. After that happens, once education improves, then come to me and have a conversation of how we are going to reach peace. And then actually, let me know if that conversation is even relevant at that point as to whether we're going to have one or two states. And so we're operating on what's comfortable for us, on what's not going to get us canceled, on what's not new, on what's tried and tested, and no Jew is willing to step out of those lines. And when one does, people are scared. He's an extremist. He may be too much. This is not our way. Sorry, let's wake up. Our way hasn't been working. It's time to try a different way. It's time to stand up strong and be forceful in what we believe in, and not just say it as if it's an opinion that you can take or disregard.
Look, this is exactly the point of what I'm trying to do here with this podcast. I'm trying to show people that there are many, many different ways to fight for Jewish civil rights, that there is not one right way. As long as we don't cross the line into violence, as long as we don't cross the line into hatred, we can fight.
I agree.
So I finish every episode with a round of what I call the Jewish lightning round.
All right.
A list of questions. Just give me the first answer if it comes to mind. Yeah. No right or wrong answers. And you get one pass if you want. AB, what is one thing people don't know about you?
One thing, I am a very shy person.
Really?
Yeah. Surprised, didn't you? Very shy.
You hide it well. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we are a tough warrior nation.
What is your favorite curse?
Yel'an Abuk.
In'al Abuk?
Yel'an Abuk.
Which means?
Screw your father. It's in Arabic. It's a nice one.
Yeah, In'al Abuk. When was the last time you cried?
I cry often. last time I cried? I don't know. Probably a few month ago.
That's not often, I have to tell you. I don't think there's a week without me crying. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
I'm going to say, Grand Mufti Hosseini.
Really?
Yeah, I love people that don't agree with me.
You'll have the Mufti over for Shabbat.
So I can debate him. I can argue with him. Honestly, if there's one person that I want to have over for Shabbat dinner, it would be the Rambam.
Rambam,
Maimonides. He's my one inspirational, if you want to say somebody I idolize, God forbid, but like an inspirational rabbinical figure, it's the Rambam because he uses a lot of logic. He wrote a book that debates with Plato, and he delves into philosophy.
A Guide for the Perplexed.
And I love that stuff. So I would love to have dinner with the Rambam, Shabbat dinner.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Hanukkah. Get canceled everywhere. I'm going to skip that one. I don't have a least favorite.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm with my wife and my children.
When do you feel least safe?
When I'm away from my wife and children, honestly. Like on a trip alone.
What gives you hope?
Me and you sitting here, knowing that before October 7th, we probably wouldn't be sitting together and being friends. That gives me hope.
That. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
This week, United Hatzalah.
United Hatzalah. Do you want like one sentence of what they do?
They are a volunteer ambulance service in Israel. They help Arabs, Christians, Jews, everybody in Israel. It's all volunteers. Eli Beer is the founder. He started it. They rely completely on, you know, people. I don't know what they rely on to operate, but it's a great ambulance service that responds, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, in under a minute and a half to every emergency call. And that was extremely brave during October 7th. Although they're volunteer paramedics, they went in under fire to help people and to rescue people. So I believe that there's also going to be a lot of trauma that comes out for these paramedics. And so I think it is essential that we do donate and help those who didn't have to, but went in and helped anyways under fire.
Amazing. We're going to put a link to United Hatzalah in this episode. Where can people find you?
On Instagram, Abraham Hamra.
You want to spell it for people?
A-B-R-A-H-A-M. H-A-M-R-A.
All right. I have to say, it is a pleasure disagreeing with you.
It was great. And I love you.
And yes, I am so glad you're in this fight.
Thank you.
With me, with all of us. So here I am with A.B. Hamra.
Thank you. It was amazing. I really want to thank you again for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to show that I'm not an insane person. Yes. I'm normal with and ideas.
I believe it. I believe every reasonable person listening to you would not even have that thought cross their mind ever again.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Atomite Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."